Your Excellency, I understand you've been combing every nook and cranny of the Eastern region. You've been in the region for about 6 days now. What does the Eastern region mean to you? Especially in terms of vote going into this year's election. How crucial is the Eastern region for you and your party?
Thank you, Mohammed. Let me thank you very much and express appreciation to the management of Sunrise FM for having me, and to say good morning to all your listeners. Let me say the campaign in the Eastern region has been very good. The Eastern region is what I'll call a battleground region, because the votes that the NDC gets here are very significant, and every election we have seen an increase in the number of votes we get in the Eastern region. And so strategically paying this much attention to the Eastern region is something that we believe will pay off. And so I've spent almost the whole of last week and yesterday and today in the Eastern region, a total of almost a week. And we've been around several constituencies, and we hope to wrap up today. We've been in Suhum, Akroso, Anuma Papam, Ayurbi yesterday, and last week we're in Asamankese, we're in Takrasi, we're in Fodwa, in Kwawu, in Sawame, Burie, Kropong, Esojamang, and also in Odumase, in the Krobo area. And everywhere we've gone, we've been very well received. Yeah, the enthusiasm is very high, and I believe that the campaign has gone quite well. We're looking to increase our share of the votes in the Eastern region, and indeed the Eastern regional executives are looking to achieve a 50-50 split of the vote, coming from about 43%. We believe that we can cover the distance of another 7 percentage points to be able to achieve 50%.
Very well. So, Agenda 50-50 is still on course. But, Your Excellency, your 2012 manifesto, for example, contains a number of promises for the region. You know, some of them you've been able to achieve or execute, while others, such as the regional hospital for Kofodia, or for the Eastern region in Kofodia, University of Environment and Sustainable Development, are yet to, if you like, see the light of day. Given the foregoing, do you think you still deserve the mandate of the people of the Eastern region?
Indeed, development under the NDC has been much more significant in the Eastern region than under the 8 years of the MPP. Yesterday, I was making a point that was drawn to my attention, that in the 8 years of the MPP, Eastern region, one single new secondary school was not built. Not a single one. Not a single hospital was built in the 8 years of MPP. Not a single one. In the period we've been in power from, let me even say from 2013 to 2016, we built 104 CHIPS compounds in the Eastern region. We're building 30 new secondary schools in the Eastern region, the community day senior high school. 13 of them are here in the Eastern region. We're building a brand new state-of-the-art hospital in Abetifi. We have passed the bill for the University of Energy and Natural Resources. And currently there is a loan agreement in Parliament to begin construction of the university. And so, yes, we haven't done the hospital yet. I know that the ministry was working on issues of where it should be situated. That is in respect of acquisition of land and the designs for the hospital. But we have promised that every region must have a first-class regional hospital. And even though we haven't built the regional hospital, the hospital we're building in Abetifi is probably equivalent to a regional hospital, because it has everything for diagnosis. It's a first-class state-of-the-art hospital. And so we have done more in Eastern region than MPP did in 8 years in government.
But Your Excellency, that notwithstanding, these are manifesto promises, and they have to be executed in order to give the people a sort of trust in the government that, okay, the government or the party promised this and they did exactly that.
Let me draw your attention to something. There are promises you make based on assumptions that you have. when you come into government, there are some realities that you confront. For instance, we had anticipated that we would build 200 schools in 4 years. Procurement, design, soil testing, and all that, acquisition of land, took 2.5 years. And so actual construction began in the third year of my administration. And so those are the realities you confront. And so you would have a manifesto promise, but when you confront the reality of the procedures you have to go through to deliver on those promises, you find that it does not always come the way you expected. But even though we said 200, at least if we were doing an exam, 123, we have passed the pass mark. And I have said in the manifesto for 2016 that from 2017 to 2021, we will build the remaining secondary schools. And so, by God's grace, I believe that Ghanaians will give us a second term. And I believe that by the finalization of my second term, we should have the regional hospital either completed or in an advanced stage of completion. There are many other promises we made. The University of Ghana Teaching Hospital, we're delivering. You know, the Upper East Regional Hospital, we're delivering. We have several other manifesto promises that, you know, are either delivered completely or in the process of being delivered.
Right. Imani Ghana, for example, scored your party, I think, 52.something% as to how far the party has been able to achieve its 2012 manifesto promises. Is that the way you see it? Do you think you deserve better?
Well, I think that on infrastructure, they scored us much higher and said that we have done a phenomenal job with infrastructure. There are other intangible promises that are not as easy to fulfill. And we continue to push them so that we're able to fulfill those promises. Raising educational standards is something that needs consistent work. You know, improving people's incomes, you need to continue to work on it. And so I believe that the Imani scores are good. I mean, above 50 is a pass mark, and so it means that Imani has passed us, and they gave us an even higher score in respect of development of social and economic infrastructure.
Right, and one area, Your Excellency, that your administration has been touting as furthest in its cap is its ability to undertake, you know, massive infrastructure projects and all that, especially in the area of education, in order to improve access and all that, and also quality. But some experts have decried the, you know, falling standard of education or the quality of education, especially at the basic level. As some of them say, some of these graduate from the basic school hardly, can write good English and speak good English. How are we trying to attend to this?
There's often a generalization that is not based on reality, and it is mostly anecdotal. I think that the media should help break those misperceptions by doing your own research and looking at the statistics. Indeed, the educational standards are getting better. They're getting better if you look at the statistics. And children are doing much better than they did in the past. The past number of them passing is increasing. Our strategy for the educational sector has been based on three prongs. The first has been to improve the quality. The second has been to improve access. And the third has been to improve affordability. And so this is the manner in which we've been tackling it. But quality is one of the major things that we've been looking at. And one of the things we targeted is the issue of teacher absenteeism. There used to be a very high level of teacher absenteeism. That is, 27% teacher absenteeism was the norm. This has been brought down significantly. And I think that currently we are at about 9%. The Ministry of Education is not letting up. And I want to thank the leadership of NAGRAT and NAT and the Ministry of Education and the Ghana Education Service for the collaboration they have done in terms of reducing teacher absenteeism. Their achievements are phenomenal. And because of that, children are getting more engagement hours with their teachers. And I think that that is what is part of reflecting in the results that the children are achieving currently. We also have reduced the ratio between trained and untrained teachers. because of the increase in the numbers of teachers in colleges of education, we have more teachers being trained, and so we're able to post more teachers out than was the case in the past. In the past, we used more untrained teachers because we didn't have enough teachers being posted. Apart from that, we're rationalizing the distribution of teachers. And so instead of having all the teachers concentrated in the urban centers, we're having more teachers fanning out into the rural areas. And so the situation where you had schools without teachers is beginning to change. And so gradually we are getting a handle on these things. Aside from that, more importantly, we have made teaching and learning materials available at both the basic level and the secondary level. The core textbooks we have printed and distributed. And so instead of a situation where children had zero textbooks, today the ratio is 4 textbooks to 1 child. And so the children have the textbooks that they are able to refer to during lessons. Before, it was only the teacher who had the textbook, and the children didn't have the textbook to refer to. Aside from that, we've distributed more than 100 million exercise books, because we noticed that the children didn't have books in which to even take their notes. Today, the children all have those notes. We've also eliminated most of the substandard schools. Even though there might be still some substandard schools around, the majority of them we have eliminated, and we continue to eliminate them. And I have said in our manifesto that by 2021, we shouldn't have any school under 3. We must have taken all of them out so that the children have a good learning and environment. In respect to access, we are putting more schools across the country so that children have access. Especially at the secondary school, a lot of children finish GHS and then they sat at home because there was no school within their community. And even though they passed, there were not enough places in secondary school for them to be placed. And so with these new schools we are building, we have started populating them with children. And so children who would have ended their education at GHS, today are continuing to SHS because we have put a school in their community. And so that is improving access. And then with regards to affordability, the first strategy we have used is to eliminate unapproved fees. A lot of the headmasters impose unauthorized fees. There are fees that are approved by the GES in consultation with the headmasters. Every year, the ministry and the GES sit with the headmasters and fix the fees. And then when the headmasters go, they go and add other fees that do not exist. And so the GES has been very firm on this. And if you've heard, some headmasters have been sanctioned, some have been suspended, you know, for imposing unauthorized fees. And so it has made a lot of them sit up, and parents are paying the right fees that are authorized. And so this has improved affordability. Aside from that, of course, with the progressive senior high school education, these students are benefiting. And this year, we have budgeted for 120,000 boarding students to begin to benefit from the progressively senior high school education. And so that is also improving, you know, affordability and making more parents send their children to school. But let me tell you about the BECE. For the first time in history, let me give you a context. In 2014, 11 students had 500 marks above what they call the 500 score, raw score. 11 students, only 11 of them. In 2015, only 2 of them had marks above the raw score of 500. The highest was 504. In 2016, you know, not 10, not 20, not 100, not 500, not 1,000, not 2,000, not 3,000. 3,994 students had a score above the 500 raw score. And indeed, the highest mark was 564 over 600. And so it shows that the students are performing much better. This year there was no exam report of exam malpractice. The children have performed better. At the secondary school level, WASI level, for the last 4 years, the top 3 performing students have come from Ghana. And indeed, last year, I presented the award to the students, and the top 3 students in West Africa were Ghanaian students and were girls, you know. And so something good is happening. And I believe that the media should do the research and let the public know that we're improving in education. And I want to thank all community leaders and others who have contributed. What we notice is there are many schools now that are public schools that are performing just as well as private school. Everybody wants to send his children to private schools because they think that the private schools are the one that are the ones that have the top performances, and your child is likely to perform well if he goes to a private school. But today, parents are sending their children to public schools, and public schools are doing well. There are schools that, you know, before you wouldn't have heard the name anywhere. In Kofori, I hear Madonna and all these schools. Today, there are other schools that are public schools that are performing just as well as Madonna. And it's because the community has taken an interest in what is happening in the school. Anytime I open a new school, I tell the chiefs, I tell them, this school, government built it, but it's for you. It's your school, and so you must take an interest in what happens there. And you find that anywhere the community is interested, working closely with the head teacher and looking after the school has started to do well. We provided them with buses, 300 buses provided to secondary schools across the country, in order that children can go on excursions, they can go to the science resource centers. We provided 200 pickups to the administration of schools across the country, so that the administration can have a vehicle to do the things that makes the school run. And so government is investing a lot, but I believe that that investment is yielding fruit because we're seeing improvements in the standards that are coming out.
Okay, so you believe the investment is indeed yielding fruit. We have just about 3 minutes more to hit 10 a.m. You're listening to the Development Agenda segment of Morning Drive at Diachimbia on 106.7 and 102.1 FM. And the program or the interview is also live on all GBC affiliates across the country. My guest this morning is Excellency, the President of the Republic of Ghana, President John Dramani Mahama. Now, still on education, since it's a very critical area which is close to the heart of most Ghanaians. Now, you promised in your 2016 or current manifesto to increase capitation, for instance, to 100%, expand school feeding program to all public and early childhood centers nationwide, review the capitation grant report, which I've already mentioned, and fully absorb BEC registration fees, including RISIT and WASI registration fees for all Ghanaian candidates. Now, given our past experience, where capitation have to go or has had to go into arrears for, I mean, so many months, and then with all the associated problems that the various institutions have to go through, how feasible are these new promises, especially given the fact that Imani, for instance, again, also estimated that you will need about $24 billion to be able to fulfill, you know, half or more than half of your promises?
I believe that we are going through an adjustment phase in the economy, and the economy is beginning to perform much better. And so we are making promises not based on today, but the projection of what the size of the economy will be between now and 2021. And that's why you make your promises based on that. We will come to the economy, but if I will just, you know, make a few points to show you what is happening in the economy, then you understand, you know, why we think that we can achieve some of the things that we've said we'll achieve. Growth is returning, and we expect that this year we'll grow at an average of about 5%. We predict about 5.3%, but the international monetary institutions predict between 4.9% and 5%. But that would be a very handsome growth if you look at what is happening in the rest of the world. I mean, even for China, that used to grow at 12%. Today, that growth has reduced to about 6%. If you look at even the most advanced countries, you're talking about 1% or below 1%. And so 5% is a handsome growth. But all of them are in conclusion. And, you know, they all agree that from 2017, our growth is going to be 8% and above. And the statistics are beginning to show. If you look at our exports as a percentage of GDP, that is the exports that we send out as a contributor to our GDP, the percentage that it contributes, it has gone up from 40% of GDP in 2012, and has risen to 44% of GDP in 2015. That is a 4% increase, which is very significant. It means that we are diversifying our exports. It means we are exporting more. We are earning more from exports as a contributor of our GDP. If you look at the growth of the service sector in 2012 was 47% of GDP, contributor to GDP. Today, the service sector is contributing 50%, half to our GDP growth. It shows you that something is happening in the economy, which is positive, apart from the general growth. In addition, we've reduced the budget deficit. We've grown revenues. Ghana has been named as the number one in ease of doing business in West Africa. These are all positives that show that this economy is growing. We're going into the main gas era from end of 2017. The Sankofa field is coming on stream. It is going to produce 150 million standard cubic feet of gas. 150 million standard cubic feet of gas can produce 1,000 megawatts of power a day. And the Sankofa field can produce 150 million standard cubic feet of gas for the next 20 years. It means 1,000 megawatts of power a day for the next 20 years. And so the prospects of this economy are good. We've done the heavy lifting. We've taken all the tough decisions to readjust the economy and bring it back on the path of growth. And so we believe that going forward, we should be able to raise the revenues to be able to deliver on the promises that we have made. And I believe that we don't make promises that we can't deliver. We make them because we have scientifically studied them and we know that we can deliver. We're not the type who go throwing around one something just because we want to win elections. We have a manifesto committee that sits and works the numbers and says that, look, this is possible, this is feasible, before we put it in our manifesto.
Very well, Your Excellency. I think one more question on education so that we move on to other areas. Now, your government...
And let me tell you even one thing. For the first time in the history of this country, the government is implementing zero central bank financing. So everything that we're paying, capitation grants, subsidies to schools, school feeding and everything, we're paying from government's own revenues. We're not borrowing from the Bank of Ghana. Every other government borrowed up to 10% of budget from Bank of Ghana. And that's why I believe that with the discipline we're finding in the economy, and with the fact that the Bank of the Parliament has said that we can do up to 5% borrowing from the central bank, which must be done in a disciplined way. But it wouldn't happen now until we exit the IMF program, because the IMF program ends in 2017. So all this time, this year, 2016 into 2017, we're implementing zero central bank financing. Nobody thought that a government could survive without borrowing from the central bank. It is happening today.
All right. Your government, you know, scrapped the paying of allowances to nurses and midwifes and then teacher trainee allowances some time ago. But then there was a recent announcement pointing to the fact that the one for nurses and midwives is going to be restored. What informed this sudden change of mind, if you like?
We believe that it was necessary to increase the number of teachers because you had schools without teachers. And we had what we call the quota system, because you had to pay trainee allowances to people studying in colleges of education, no training colleges at the time. Now what happened was, let me talk about the training colleges and then I'll come to the nurses. What happened was that we took a decision that we're going to upgrade all the training colleges into colleges of education, degree awarding tertiary institutions. Now, it's not only the colleges of education that train teachers. University of Education Winneba trains teachers. University of Cape Coast trains teachers. University of Ghana Legon offers educational training, teacher training. Now, all the students who go to the established universities, Cape Coast, Winneba, Legon, take student loans. But then, at the time that these colleges of education were training colleges, because we wanted to reduce the number of pupil teachers and wanted more trained teachers, we instituted the teacher trainee allowances. And so it had continued for a period of time. But when we brought them to university status, that is degree awarding status, then they became equivalent to their colleagues in the established universities. Now, one, you have a problem of equity. Based on where you get your teacher education certificate, either a college of education or an established university, you either earn trainee allowances or you take student loan. And so for the sake simply of even equity, once they are all degree awarding, they're coming out with the same certificate, they're going to teach in the same schools, they will earn the same salaries. On a matter of equity, it was necessary to take away the trading allowances and put them also on the student loan, because that's what all tertiary institutions are on. So that's the first one. The second one was access. Because of the weight of trainee allowances on the budget, the colleges of education were not able to admit the full remit of their capacity to be able to train. And so it meant that we had fewer teachers coming out when you needed teachers in the rural schools and other schools. And so we said, look, let's put them on the student loan and let's increase the capacity of the colleges of education to train more teachers so that we can have more teachers to go into the schools. And so what we did was a substitution of the trainee allowances for student loans like every other tertiary student is earning. And because of that, admission to colleges of education has increased 63%. 63% of those currently in colleges of education would not be there if we were paying trainee allowances. That is the fact. And so it is a matter of principle. I am a principled public servant. If I wanted to score cheap political point like people want to score, they promise them that when they come, they'll restore it. On what basis? On what principle? On what principle? Just because you want to win
elections. Why are you restoring that of the...
I'm coming to that. I told you I'll finish with the colleges of education. And so 63% of those in colleges of education are there because we took away the trainee allowances and replaced it with student loans. And now we've even increased the amount you can take as student loans. And once you take the student loan, because there's no freeze on employment for teachers, you'll be able to pay. Because once you go and you're teaching, we will deduct it gradually over a period so that we can use it to provide to your younger brother who would also be coming after you. So that's to do with the teachers. With regards to the nurses, we had increased the number of nursing training colleges. And so currently we have in excess of 34 nursing training colleges, and we've increased phenomenally the number of nurses who are training. And so in their case too, we had decided that, look, we're going to put them on the student loan. Indeed, the MPP government had started it in 2008. They came out with a memo where they said that they were going to scrap nursing training allowances and that the money was to be invested in expanding access, you know, for employment to nurses. There's a memo. I'll find it for you before we leave here, you know, where they had prepared to scrap nursing training allowances. And so it is a very unprincipled stand for them to turn around and say that, oh, when they come back, they'll restore nursing training allowances. So this was a decision that was taken. But then it was realized that the Student Loan Act did not allow nursing training colleges to benefit from student loan. So it means that you need to go to Parliament and amend the Student Loan Act. And so a committee was set up and they said, look, while you're going to go through this process of amending the Student Loan Act, restore an abated allowance to the nursing trainees so that they are able to take care of some of their academic costs and needs. And so the committee recommended to the Ministry of Finance to pay an abated allowance. As I speak, the ministry has released the abated allowance and the accountant general has approved it, and it is being paid into the accounts of the nursing training colleges to be paid to the nursing trainees. This abated allowance will continue until we are able to amend the Student Loan Act so that then we can put the nursing trainees onto the student loan. The thing is, for health workers and teachers, there is no freeze on employment. And so if you give them a student loan, they are capable of paying because their employment is automatic. And so they'll be employed into the health sector or into the educational sector. And then you can always deduct the student loan because they are known, their salaries are known. You can take the student loan gradually and then replace it so that you can give it to others. So that is the issue with nursing trainees and teacher trainees.
Very well, Your Excellency. You mentioned that there isn't a freeze on the teachers and the nursing trainees in the sense that once they complete, they are enrolled into the various educational and, you know, health institutions, as the case may be. But then we've had concerns expressed by various student groups, I mean teacher trainee groups, nurses, about unemployment, the fact that they've completed for so many months and they haven't been enrolled into any health or teaching institution to work.
Again, it is because of the process. The process of verification. In the past, as soon as they came out, they were posted. And then once they were posted, it took time for work to be done on their particulars so that they could be placed on the payroll. Now, that process created a situation where teachers were posted, they won't report at post, you understand? But then their names appear on the payroll and government continues to pay. All of us have been shouting about the issue of ghost names and say that government is losing money, there's waste because people are being paid who are ghosts. And so from 2013, we took a decision that we're going to meticulously verify everybody before you were placed on the payroll. And it is that process of verification that, you know, has to be done before they are put on the payroll that has created the backlog that we face. Aside from that, in the peculiar case of the nurses, aside from the public nursing training colleges that government has established, that we bond the nurses because government is contributing to their education, and so we expect that they would work in the public sector. There are community nursing training institutions and private nursing training institutions that government didn't set up, but who are also producing nurses. And so we need to find a way of absorbing all of them as quickly as possible. And that is why this government is investing in facilities to create employment for nurses. In 8 years, like I told you, in the Eastern region, not a single hospital was built. So where do you expect all the nurses who are coming out to go and work? Under this administration, we've built more than 20 district hospitals. We're building teaching hospitals. We're building regional hospitals. We're building health centers. We're building polyclinics. We built almost 35 polyclinics. We built 1,600 CHIPS compounds. That is creating employment opportunity for nurses. In 8 years, the MPP didn't build one secondary school in Eastern Region. We are building 13 secondary schools in Eastern Region. That is what is going to create employment for teachers. And so while you are training teachers, you must also be creating the opportunity for them to be employed when they finish school. And that is what this government is doing. That is what this government is doing. And that's why if you look at the numbers, and I'd say that the media should help us, you know, by looking at the numbers. From 2009 till date, this government has employed 78,000 teachers, unprecedented, the highest number in the history of the country. And from 2013, when I became president, we've employed 23,000 nurses, unprecedented, the highest number ever in the history of this country. And so the facts do not support, you know, some of the conclusions that are generally thrown, bandied about in the media. This government is doing its best, and indeed it's doing creditably, to provide more opportunities for teachers and nurses to be educated. And like I told you, I said that when I was talking about the nurses and the trainee allowances, there is a document which is dated 9th June 2008. And it says guidelines for the preparation of 2009 to 2011 plans and budget. And this is from the Ministry of Health. And it was signed by the Deputy Minister of Health at the time. And he said that I have the pleasure to share the 2009-2011 planning and budgeting guidelines. You know, and under those planning and budgeting guidelines, it says that The management of the wage component will remain a major challenge in 2009. To face the challenge, the following efficiency measures have been proposed for implementation. One, to ensure a clean payroll, staff on the current payroll of the Ghana Health Service, but who are providing service to auxiliary organizations outside the sector, are to be transferred wholesale to their host institutions. It meant that staff of GHS, Ghana Health Service, who were on secondment to other institutions, were to be transferred to those institutions. Then, this is the key one. It says, trainee allowances to new entrants to the diploma programs in various training institutions, that is the nursing training institutions, will be abolished. This is the MPP government in 2008. It says training allowances to new entrants to the diploma programs in the various training institutions will be abolished. Allowances to continuing students in the diploma program will also be phased out. And then it says that all students will be encouraged to seek funding under the student loan scheme. This is the MPP government for you. Today the same party turns around and says that, you know, we're wicked to have removed trainee allowances and what and what. And then you see Bawredu's letter. He was the Minister of Finance at the time, to the Director General of the Ghana Education Service. This is Bawredu's letter. And it says that it's dated July 2008. And it says that apart from measures to control the wage bill to ensure efficient management of public expenditures, it has been decided that all ministries, departments, and agencies should freeze the recruitment of new staff whose salaries were not budgeted for in the 2008 budget estimates. The total staff strength captured in the 2008 budget estimates will serve as the base for MDA recruitment and adjustments. Ghana Education Services to operate within 2008 budget allocation at a staff strength of 245,000 and only seek financial clearance to recruit in the case of replacement staff. The Ministry of Finance and Economic Planning will not be obliged to make payments of personal emoluments above the budgeted staff strength after approval. Please note the appropriate restrictive controls and sanctions will be applied to those who recruit new staff outside the policy. So what it means is that in 2008, they had budgeted for 245,000 teachers. And they said that don't employ any teacher above the 245,000. And that if you employ, don't pay. This is what Ministry of Finance was saying in 2008. And so the duplicity of the MPP is so appalling. You know, history is a very important subject, and you must always remember your past so that it guides you to the future. It looks like the MPP has forgotten its past completely. And because of opportunism of trying to win political power, you just come and make criticisms and highfalutin promises that only recently in the past you yourself were, you know, kicking against.
Right, thank you very much, Your Excellency. Now, still on health, nurses at the Accra Psychiatric Hospital started an indefinite strike today, per a report I read this morning, in protest of the indecent conditions at work and government failure to provide them with supplies. The Mental Health Authority has, as a result, ordered management of the hospital to discharge more than 300 patients on admission at the facility. Has this come to your attention?
No, it hasn't come to my attention, but I do know that the area of mental health is one of the areas where we need to focus attention. I mean, it is as psychiatrists tell us that all of us have a bit of madness in us, and that somehow we all have some mental disorder or the other. And so it means that it is something that we need to pay attention to. We passed the new mental health bill, and government is committed to its implementation. We will take immediate steps to resolve the issue at the Accra Psychiatric Hospital. And I'm going to call the Minister of Health after this program to see what the issues are and see how we resolve them. But going forward, in our manifesto, we have a clear plan for mental health. What we have said is that we're going to move the Accra Psychiatric Hospital from where it is currently, Asylum Down, and we're going to move it to Pantan Hospital and develop Pantan Hospital into a first-class, state-of-the-art mental health facility so that we have their budget in one place and we're able to pay more attention to that hospital than having this scattered, you know, system that we currently have. Aside from that, we have opted to build two new mental hospitals, one in Kumasi and one in a location in the north, one of the three northern regions, to cater for mental health cases in those geographical regions. Currently, because we have only the Pantang Hospital, the Accra Psychiatric Hospital, and the Ankafo Hospital, any mental health patient has to be brought down to one of these three facilities. And so we need to spread the availability of mental health so that we don't have overcrowding and too much pressure on the facilities that we currently have. But one, we're going to consolidate Accra Psychiatric Hospital and the Pantang Hospital so that they become one unit. And then we'll continue to provide support to the Ankafo Hospital. And then we'll provide two new hospitals in the Middle Belt and the Northern Belt so that it's able to serve, you know, as many patients as possible. But aside from that, we also need to decentralize mental care. And so in the existing hospitals, we will post psychiatric nurses and other mental health professionals, so that even in the existing hospitals, if you report, you can get initial care while a reference is done for you to go to a specialized facility.
All right, Your Excellency, seems like time is really running out, but we'll try and compress one or two questions in here before you go. Let's look at disability. I'd like to recommend your party in the first place for making, for instance, a Braille version of your manifesto so that visually impaired people can read and understand what is in there. And then I'm sure you have quite some good promises in your manifesto for people. But a decade after the passage of the Disability Act and the enactment of the UN Convention on Persons with Disability, rights of persons with disability continue to be infringed upon. For example, most buildings, including even government structures, are not disability friendly. Why is it so?
The proportion of our population that is described as fiscally challenged is about 10%, and so that puts it at a little over 2 million people. This is a significant proportion of our population, and these are our brothers and sisters. I had a brother who was physically challenged. Yeah, he passed away, unfortunately. But the reality is that all of us, you know, either have a friend or a relative who faces physical challenges. And so society must pay more attention. And this is exactly what this government is doing. Under the Livelihood Empowerment Against Poverty program, we have specifically targeted persons with disability. And so currently on the LEAP program, we have 50,000 persons with disability who are either heads of households or live in an environment that makes it difficult for them to earn an income. We have put them on the LEAP program, and we'll continue to target and put more of them on the LEAP program. This government has also apportioned a certain percentage of the District Assembly's Common Fund in every district to be disbursed to persons with disability, in order that they are able to do their programs. In many districts, they are using it for very, very meaningful projects that is benefiting persons with disability. Only in this year's budget, we increased that fund by another 100%, in order that it's able to give them more money to be able to do the things that they need to do. On the day that we presented a Braille version of our manifesto, I also presented tricycles, motorized tricycles, for trial. And they are locally manufactured. And if they are they prove to be good, we'll give them to our brothers and sisters who are physically challenged so that they can also move around freely. Apart from that, we've registered more than 4,000 persons with disability on the NHIs free of charge. The Ministry of Gender has done that so that they are able to access health care. We also are encouraging the we have passed the UN Convention on persons with disability. We've ratified it, and then we've also approved the UN Marrakesh Treaty. It's gone to Parliament for ratification, which affords published works to be translated into Braille. It means that all public works must be translated into Braille so that the blind have access to as many of the public works as possible. And so these are all things that we are putting together. But with regards to access, we have worked with the Ghana Standards Authority to finalize and standardize disability-friendly buildings. And so what we're doing is we're taking the education sector, like schools, like Ghana Education Service offices. We're taking the health sector, like hospitals, like offices of the health services. We're taking the ministries and others. And we've come with designs that say that if you are building anywhere in this country, any such office or school or something, this is the design it must have, so that persons with disability have access to the building. So those designs are ready, and they are going to be given to all the departments and agencies. And so in future, if they are building any offices, those are the designs that they must use. The problem has been with existing buildings that were built that are not disability friendly. We need to identify all those buildings, and then in some of them, we are asking that they put ramps so that people are able to access. But there are several of the buildings that were built long ago that do not even have lifts. They have only stairs. And so it makes it very difficult to put a ramp. But we're asking all ministries to look at and budget for making their buildings more disability friendly. In some of the cases where there are difficulties, we're asking them to bring the offices in their ministries that interface with the public to the ground floor. And so if there's an office where people have to go and make payment to a cashier or something, instead of having it on the second floor or the first floor, you must bring it to the ground floor so that it makes it easier for people with physical disability to be able to access. So those are all ongoing measures that we are taking, and I believe that we should have a handle on it.
Okay. Your Excellency, in just a minute, what's your take on, Father's Day being declared as maybe National Prostate Cancer Day?
Father's Day?
Yes.
I believe that we must create awareness of prostate cancer because it's the number one killer of men. And most people die out of ignorance. I am aware of prostate cancer because my father died of prostate cancer. And so I know what he went through. And so it's made me very aware of prostate cancer. My stepmother died of breast cancer, so it's made me very aware of breast cancer too. Prostate cancer is the number one killer of men, and so we must create awareness. Number one cancer killer of men. Of all the cancers that kill men, prostate cancer is number one. So we must all be aware of it. Men must regularly have their PSA taken. The PSA is a test that is done to see if the prostate is giving some signal. It's a signal the prostate gives. And if it goes above a certain figure, you need to continue to test to see if it's rising or it's declining. If it's rising, then you must go for a biopsy. A biopsy means you go, they do keyhole surgery, they take a bit of the prostate and they go and test it to see if there is a cancer in it. They will also do MRI scans to see if there is any mass in your prostate or if it is growing abnormally. These are all things that men must be conscious of. And so I call on all my colleague men, at least twice a year, do a PSA and make sure that your PSA numbers are not rising. If they are rising, consult your doctor. But we need to look at issues of lifestyle choices. It is said that prostate cancers are the result of lifestyle. Depending on what you're doing, smoking or eating late, or you're obese or things like that, they're all predisposing factors to it. And then aside from that, we should look at occupational health and safety practices for workers so that they are not exposed to hazardous chemicals and things, because that can also be a predisposing factor to prostate cancer. But I say that as men, we should come together and also advocate. the women have been strong advocates for having breast and cervical cancer put on the NHIS. So if you have breast cancer today, you go to a hospital, you are treated on NHIS free. If you have cervical cancer, you are treated on NHIS free. But you have prostate cancer, it's not treated by NHIS. And a lot of men are suffering from prostate cancer. And so I'm going to be the chief advocate. Me and all my colleague men, let's rise up and let's get NHIS to also admit prostate cancer on the NHIS.
All right, Your Excellency. Now, let's look at state institutions. Recently, during an inauguration of a new fleet of buses for the STC, you promised to ensure that the company works as long as you remain president. Other public institutions like our own GBC has its own problems and issues. What package do you have for us?
My crusade is that we cannot say that public institutions cannot work efficiently. And I'm seeing examples where just by simple change of management, we're seeing public institutions turn around. It is a management issue. And we need to address this. We need an attitudinal change in all our public institutions that says that the work is not for my father. I mean, when you're working efficiently in an organization, what people ask you is, Ejumande, what papa dia? Is the work for your father? But they forget that if the institution collapses, all of you are going to go home and it's going to stop putting food on the table for you. This is what I was telling the STC workers. So if you see somebody stealing a part or somebody doing something that is antisocial, it will affect you in the long run, because if the institution collapses, all of you are going to go home. They're not going to say that person who was stealing spare parts and things is the only one to go home and you must remain and work. And so the institution is for our father. Yes, it is for us. It is for our children. It's for our children's children. And state institutions can work as efficiently as private institutions. And so I was very excited about the new enthusiasm I saw in state transport. And I know that organization would do well. We're giving them 50 brand new buses, and we're giving them a period to pay. So they've set up an escrow account. Or every day, a little of their revenue they'll put in their account to pay for the buses. And I've told them that if they're able to pay for those buses, government will guarantee another set of buses for them. And they must run it properly. And you can see that the STC workers are excited. All of them have promised to get on board. They've introduced a new online system for booking your ticket. So you don't need to go and queue at the cashier's office at STC and buy your ticket. You can go online, book your ticket, and then when you go, you just go and board your bus. You can pay with mobile money or any of the electronic payment methods. And so I can see that institution will do well. If you look at TOR, we have fixed TOR. Today, TOR is working efficiently again. And for the first time in history, we're going to bring crude oil from Ghana's oil field to refine in TOR this month in November. And that shows you the turnaround that is taking place in the establishment. You go to Gapoha. Gapoha is working well. Recently, I was there. They've built a new jetty using their own funds. They bought new tugboats, to be able to pull ships into the harbor and all kinds of things. They are going to sign an agreement this month in November with their partners, Meridian Port Services, for a $1 billion expansion of Tema Port without any government financing, they and their partners. We've given the shipyard to Gapoha. Gapoha is getting partners to turn that shipyard around and make it the number one dry dock and shipyard in the whole of Ghana. You go to the bulk oil storage terminal. It was one of the most indebted state institutions in Ghana. Today, BOSS is making profit and is raising investments to make key strategic investments in various projects. And so I believe that state institutions can perform and perform properly. And as long as we change our attitudes that the institutions do not belong to our fathers, if we change that attitude and know that this is the institution that puts food on our plate, I believe that we can turn state institutions around. Government will continue to encourage state institutions to do so, because we're a social democratic government. We believe that there must be competition between the private sector and the public sector. And so we will give state institutions all the support they deserve. I believe that GBC is a good institution. It has the widest coverage in television and radio across our country. And GBC can earn enough money to look after itself without even government support. But yet, government is supporting GBC. What is easier to do? Government says, we'll pay all your salaries. Just run your operations efficiently and be able to buy your own equipment and things. It shouldn't be difficult to do that. If I had a business, somebody says, I'll pay salaries for you. All you do, you keep your revenues and, you know, do what you want. You know, it's good. But I believe that the new era into which we're going would be good for GBC. Because we're going into the digital terrestrial transmission era. The network is more than 90% complete, I hear, and it will be completed very soon. And when it is completed, GBC would be able to earn, you know, good money on its broadcast, because GBC will control the system and will give out the set-top boxes. And of course, GBC will earn money from, you know, the transmission that is done. So the future looks good for GBC, and I will be a number one supporter, having been Minister of Communications and having participated in the retooling of GBC under the Road and Schwartz program and the previous Sony program. I believe that GBC is a very important and precious state institution that must be supported to be able to provide efficient service to the public.
Right, thank you very much, Your Excellency. You're listening to Adiachi Ibia. This segment is the Development Agenda segment. My guest is His Excellency, the President of the Republic of Ghana, President John Dramani Mahama, and we are almost in home stretch, but let's touch briefly on Agric and then maybe something on Galamsey so that we bid our listeners farewell. Now, in Agric, agriculture is known as the backbone of Ghana's economy, yet most of the facilities that were hitherto provided to support agricultural growth, for example fertilizers, mass cocoa spraying exercise and all that, have more or less like stalled or dwindled. This, most of us believe, could be the reason why the agri sector has taken a nosedive in recent time. How do you intend to address this downturn?
You know, here again you have a lot of misinformation, and this is misinformation that can easily be cross-checked, and that's why normally I expect the media to go beyond the political propaganda and look at the real figures. Agric is growing, and agric is growing phenomenally. It's not dwindling. Indeed, we have achieved food self-sufficiency in all the staple products that we produce. Ghana is producing enough cassava to feed itself, even more than we need. Ghana is producing enough plantain to feed itself, even more than we need. Ghana is producing enough yam to feed itself, even more than we need. We're actually exporting yam. And so the staple foods that Ghanaians are used to, that we eat, we are producing. The ones that we import, we are making progress. We are producing 60% of total rice consumed. We anticipate that about 1 million, a little over 1 million tons of rice is being produced, is being consumed locally. We're producing 604,000 tons of rice per year. And if you look in the Green Book, you see the increase in rice production. In 2008, rice production was 301,000 metric tons. Today, rice production is 604,000 metric tons. That's a 100% increase in rice production. And so when people tell you agriculture is dwindling, you know, it's not based on any facts. Indeed, agriculture growth is higher than it has ever been. Indeed, rather, under the MPP administration in 2007, agric contracted by 1.7%. It meant that our agriculture production went down by 1.7%. Since I've been in government, agriculture growth has been consistent. In 2015, it was above 2%, and it keeps growing. We continue to supply fertilizer to farmers. Indeed, fertilizer coverage in 2008 was 8 kilos per hectare. That is the amount of fertilizer averagely farmers used in Ghana. In 2013, fertilizer coverage per hectare was 12 kilograms. So it means that our farmers are receiving more fertilizer and using more fertilizer than they used in the past. And if you look at all the statistics, I mean, if you take something like maize, that is cereals, millet, sorghum, and others, there's been an increase from 1,900 metric tons in 2008 to 1,900 metric tons to 2,100,000 metric tons in 2014. If you take roots and tubers, it's increased from 19 million metric tons to 27 million metric tons from 2008 to 2014. So agriculture is growing. This thing about agriculture production dwindling is political propaganda. It's not supported by any facts anywhere. If anybody tells you that agriculture is dwindling, ask them for their facts. Unless they have figures that they are bringing from Jupiter or Mars, the figures that I know in Ghana show that agriculture production is on the rise, both in terms of volume and in terms of the growth of the sector.
Okay. Your Excellency, but some will say to the ordinary person who goes to the market to buy maybe a tuber of yam and all that, statistics don't really mean anything to that person. Or what the person wants is, okay, we are producing enough food stuffs in our country and the prices should commensurate, you know, the level of production.
The prices are determined by various factors, and the factors generally impact with results to inflation. So you are not talking about production now, you are talking about the price and inflation, how the prices
but
rise.
Supply has a relationship.
Supply
with
plays a role, but the point is, what I'm saying is, supply is increasing. There are other factors that affect it. For instance, petrol. If prices of petroleum products increase, the trucks that bring the food from the rural areas to the markets are charging more. And so it's not that there is not volume or there is not production, but it is that a factor in the production chain has gone up.
Okay.
And that is transportation. If the roads are not good, the truck that goes to the rural area to pick the crops will charge more, because he has to go on a rough road, he might break a shock absorber, he might bust a tire, and so he'll charge you more to bring that food to the market. The traders themselves look at their production cost and the cost they have to cover and their income they must earn, and they charge accordingly. And so it is not about production and volume, it is about other factors in the value chain.
Okay.
And that is what we are addressing. That's why I'm fixing roads. Why do you think I'm fixing roads all over the country? I'm fixing them because I want the truck to be able to go into the rural areas and bring more food.
So more or less like first in first.
Exactly. So you must tackle it from other various angles. Why are we modernizing and expanding the market? So that more traders can come in, so that more food can come into the market. Because when you have a small market and it's restricted to a few traders, then they resort to what they call price fixing. They decide that the price of yam must not be lower than this, and then everybody is forced to sell at that price. But if you have a bigger market and more food is coming into the market and there are more traders, then it makes it difficult to fix prices. And so those are some of the things that we're working on. But if you look generally, I believe that the price of food will continue to be stable. We're not saying that it should come down, but we're saying that it should be stable. And that is why we're doing all the economic reforms to stabilize the economy so that inflation will come down. Inflation means that the prices of goods and services are not increasing astronomically. And that is why we're doing all that work to stabilize the economy. And I believe that with the work we're doing with the roads, the assistance we're giving with farmers, the new markets we're building to open up places where people can go easily and buy their food crops, we'll see a stabilization in food prices going forward.
All right. Your Excellency, one of the most serious security and environmental threats to the region is, you know, the activities of both local and foreign illegal miners who cause destruction to our land, water bodies, cocoa farms with impunity. There's been allegations about involvement of some chiefs and even some government officials, you know, in this act. What are you doing, or what do you intend to do about it in order to find a lasting solution to this menace?
In the past, the solution we have adopted is to get policemen and soldiers to chase the young boys all over the place, arrest them, seize their equipment and all that. We're entering an era where we're de-emphasizing that. We think that we can approach it in a more scientific manner. And so I said in Chibi, and when we did the rally there, I announced that we're coming out with a new mining code. This new mining code is going to segment the mining sector further. Under current minerals and mining law, we have two categories of mining. We have large-scale mining and small-scale mining. At the time, large-scale mining was Anglo Gold, Ashanti, Goldfields, Chirano Mines, and those kinds of large operators, Newmont and others. And then small-scale miners were miners who used shovels and pickaxes, and they went and dug somewhere small, they washed, they got a little gold, and they came and sold it. Since that time till now, a new category of mining companies has come up. These are medium-scale miners. They are not large-scale like the gold fields and things, but they are also not artisanal miners because they are using excavators and bulldozers. They are also using dynamite. They are blasting and so on and so forth. And so we are adjusting the Minerals and Mining Code to take cognition of the difference in the small-scale mining sector. And that means that we are taking out the artisanal miners and making them a different category, and then we're bringing the medium-scale mining companies. The medium-scale mining companies, we're going to hold them to a higher level of reclamation. Right now, they have no obligation to reclaim because they are considered small-scale. So what they do is they just go dig. When they finish, they move their excavator and their machines and they go to another place, go and dig. When they finish, they move. So the medium-scale miners will sign agreements with government. They will pay a certain portion of revenue as a bond to reclaim the area. And so when they finish mining, they are enjoined to reclaim the area, and then their bond will be released to them. If they do not reclaim the area, then the bond will be executed and the money taken to reclaim the area. That is for the medium-scale miners. But for the small-scale artisanal miners, we're going to let them form cooperatives. We recommend that they should have about 21 people in one cooperative. And in every district where they are working, they should go to the district assembly. There'll be a district mining officer, and there'll be a district mining office. They should go and register as a mining cooperative and indicate where they want to mine. If that place it has no encumbrances or anything, they'll be allotted a portion where they can mine. Now, as they mine, either daily or weekly, they'll put a little money aside in an account. They'll be made to open an account, and that account will be a fixed account. That means you can't draw money from it. And then every week or something, they'll put a little money that they make from their operations in there. When they have finished mining the area, we will let them form a gang, and then we'll give them that money and let them get the equipment to level the area and push back the topsoil and then plant some seedlings on it so that we can reclaim the area. We're also going to form labor gangs so that some of that money, if the artisanal miners don't reclaim it, we will pay other young people, it will give them a job, to come and level the area and reclaim the area nicely, plant seedlings on it again so that the area grows again. But one of the things we're going to do is to stop alluvial mining because of the pollution of water bodies. Today, if you see the Birim River, I mean, it's so sad. I mean, the siltation, the color. This used to be very clear water. Today it's brown and muddy. It's like any of the rivers you find in the north. It's in the north that we knew you'd find rivers with brown water because of erosion. Because of erosion in an upper course of a river. If you study geography, you know, rivers in the upper courses carry a lot of silt. And that's why rivers in the north are brown. But when they come down south, they've deposited a lot of the silt. And so by the time they're flowing through the south and going to the sea, they're very clear, transparent water. In the past, you could just fetch the brim water and drink it without fear of any poisoning or anything. Today, if you attempt to drink the brim water, you will probably, you know, find yourself at the end of your life. And so one of the things we're going to do is to clamp down on alluvial mining in order to protect our water bodies. But like I said, we're going to resegment the mining laws so that we make allowance for large scale, medium scale, and artisanal miners, and each of them will have their different responsibilities, so that we don't have to take soldiers and police and keep chasing our people around and all that.
All right. Your Excellency, we have some few days more to the 2016 election. Rhetorics here, rhetorics there, rhetorics everywhere. With some violent rhetorics, for instance, emanating from some sections of the political space, and given how, you know, the EC and the police have identified some flashpoints, how prepared are the security services to deal with any outbreak of violence in the aftermath of the elections?
Indeed, we are scheduling a National Security Council meeting, and the National Security Council is the highest body responsible for security in this country, and we are asking all the sector security heads to bring their strategy for election security to the National Security Council. We'll go through it and then we'll approve it, so that we know what the positioning is, you know, how they are taking cognition of the flashpoints that have been identified and all that. Aside from that, the services are going to go on joint security exercises and all that to raise the morale of the security services in advance of the elections. I do believe that our security services have what it takes to be able to police and monitor this election. We find that every year before an election, there are all these, you know, fears that are raised. I mean, a lot of panic is spread across. But we've held 6 successful elections. I don't anticipate that this one will be any different. But our security services are in the position and ready, you know, to quell any untoward incidents that occurs. And I must say that as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of Ghana, I will live up to my responsibility to ensure that peace is maintained before, during, and after the election.
All right, Your Excellency, we are about wrapping up. So, your message to the people of the Eastern Region, and what next after your Eastern Regional Campaign?
A prayer mantem, me person me chamu yina na me damu asenso em se beye na wotwinia me ba aprobo ewo East Region na bebia makobia nipa epie abeshia me yade a me ni asopa me person me da ahemfo ema hema Sirki Zongo for Imam ene East Region amamfo nyina person me damu ase ene awawa tu strongwa mode mami abra me ba Eastern Region ha me wo GDA se yemai Ghana nam kwan papa so na me wo gide nso se enhyehye ayeye enhyehye papa ene mpunto a ye de ba ebe ma Ghana edru pempenso bia ebe dane krabehwe ewo West Africa ha na me nua no mo ka krobo so me se mohe Damasi, Omo Moka, House and so, Nago de Kuduka, Munagodia, Alibamu Nasara, Alibamu Sa, Alemema Itamuna.
Ami. Mungo de Kore Kore, Your Excellency.
Munago de Kore.
All right. So that was His Excellency John Dramani Mahama, President of the Republic of Ghana and Commander in Chief of the Ghana Armed Forces. He has been our guest on this morning's edition of The Morning Driver, Diachi Bia, the segment christened Development Agenda. Your Excellency, we are really grateful for your time. We wish you well.
Thank you very much. God bless you.
God bless you too.